Well, Dan, I heard San Francisco now has a large percentage of people that have received their second dose. Number one in the world is what I've heard.
Getting
was it
up
easy
there,
for you to get your own?
Yeah, you know, we're getting up there. I think we might be tied with Seattle, or they might have pulled ahead a little bit. But yeah, we're doing a lot better than before. You know, before it was kind of hard to get an appointment in the early days back in May when it first rolled out. Mm-hmm. They had to get mine out of town in a place mm-hmm. like Fresno. It's a 4-hour drive away from San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a smaller city, so reservations for the vaccine were available. But what was hard for me was finding a car to get out there because I don't own a car here. Used to own one, but didn't see much use for it, right? And I think
Isn't that strange since no one's driving? Why would you have a tough time getting a car?
Yeah, so I wasn't sure. The only car that I could find was this Ford Mustang at the budget at a hotel street for me. It's the only car they had in inventory, so I got lucky enough to reserve that. Cost me $200.
Wow. Okay.
Drove.
Is that for
4-hour drive in a Ford Mustang? For one day. It was took it out and brought it back. So I kind of looked at some what's going on after that, and it turns out there is an uptick in demand for rental cars. At the same time, a lot of the rental companies apparently got rid of their fleets during the pandemic because you know, at the very beginning, we just had a drop in demand for travel in general. The car rental companies got rid of their fleets, and then suddenly everybody wanted to drive a private car instead of flying. Mm-hmm. So they're struggling to get cars. At the same time, there's a big chip shortage preventing, you know, easy access to cars. And I think, yeah, more and more people are leisure too. People are trying to rent cars for leisure purposes. Now that they've been vaccinated. And that led to a decrease in available cars and a jump in price. I read that Chicago saw a 300% increase in prices for rental cars.
Okay. So
it's crazy.
That's insane. So what did you end up doing?
Yeah, so that was it. I had to take that car for $200.
Well, you did take the two, okay.
I did, yeah, take the 4-hour drive out to Fresno. So yeah, the vaccine was free, but the car wasn't.
So that's interesting because I know there's a lot of solutions out there. So you went to budget, right? Mm-hmm. Is that where you got your car from? And there's different solutions out there right now, right? You can go to Turo, which is a peer-to-peer sharing.
Yeah.
But the problem with Turo is you still have to go pick up the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And there is the delivery, but there's a giant delivery fee to get that car to you. Yeah. That's a pain point for me because specifically if you live in San Francisco, right, it sounds like it's easy to get from point A to point B, but walking over those hills is a real nightmare. So fortunately, the guest we have today has started a new company that solves this problem. Welcome to Mobility Now, the podcast that looks at mobility technology sitting at the edge of today, but the center of tomorrow. I'm your host, Amit Mehta, Head of Innovation at Silicon Valley Lab.
And I'm your co-host, Dan Davies, Innovation Manager at North American Lighting, a fully owned subsidiary of Coital. We are the world's largest manufacturer of headlamps for cars.
So you had some information, Dan, that the car rental market itself was valued around $86 billion in 2020, and it's expected to grow by 7%. To $131 billion by 2026. But this, you're saying this isn't specifically just the car rentals and the car rental companies. It's an expanding market share, right?
Yeah, the market research I was looking at is for the car rental industry in general. I don't know if that's going to include services like Zipcar and Turo that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Certainly growing demand.
So as I said earlier, before this was, there's a company that's solving the pain points of a rental car company, which is getting the car yourself, getting it fueled, and not having to deliver it back somewhere. So before we get started onto who our guest is today, I want to introduce Ludwig, who is the CEO of Kite. Hi, Ludwig.
Hi, thanks for having me, you both.
No problem. It's a pleasure to have you as our guest today. And before we really get into who you are and what it is exactly you do. What is Kite?
Well, Kite, to put it very simply, Kite is the best way to get a car. That's what is Kite. Our vision ultimately is to give people better access to fewer cars, and we've been doing that, we believe, quite successfully just recently. Always great to hear about user pain that we think we're able to solve.
Great. So now that we know what Kite is, could you give us a little bit about your background? How did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, happy to, and would love to take the time to introduce obviously my co-founders who started this journey with me from the very start. We all came from different aspects of the transportation ecosystem. Francesco, one of my two co-founders, was at BMW and led a product team to really build out kind of their car sharing, ride-hailing portfolio. They had a product in life in Seattle. They had one in China. Really deeply ingrained in the ecosystem. My other co-founder, Nikolaus, was at Uber at the time in the machine learning AI team in within the Maps organization. So really build some of the core infrastructure for what was kind of Uber's core infrastructure for the core product, but also for what later became Uber Eats and what is today a large chunk of their business. Before coming to the Bay Area, I was in consulting, worked a lot with the auto manufacturers on trying to help them kind of figure out their positioning and their role in the future of shared autonomous electrified mobility and urban and beyond mobility, helped start a captive bank for one of them. So really came from different kind of aspects of the transportation ecosystem. We're all German, but met in the Bay. And started the San Francisco Bay Area, started the company here. We've been urban dwellers ourselves all our lives, and we've seen the $140 billion in venture capital that were poured into what was really kind of the intra-city transportation market, right? There's the ride-sharing players, the micromobility, autonomous taxis, and all of that was really for short trips, let's say up to half an hour. But what we realized, not a lot of people are paying attention to is kind of that other part of the market, which is, longer than an Uber ride, for which the car is the best option to get around, and very often the only option to really get around. And for these trips, there are a couple of options in the space, and you had mentioned a few. In car sharing and the peer-to-peer world, it's really difficult to make a consistent experience work, by nature of having distributed assets across the city, or by nature of using other people's cars. It is a large, it's a very difficult thing to make work, consistent experience and quality every time. Then there are the traditional car rental players where, one could argue, sometimes they make it a little bit too hard to enjoy the experience, right? Especially when you're in the city and you need a car. You don't have one, and Dan, you've kind of alluded to the lack of choice. You had to go to a hotel. You don't have a car, so how are you getting to the hotel? You probably took an Uber, or you took some form of other mobility, which we don't think is the best way to do it. And then you obviously have car ownership and ownership alternatives like leasing or subscriptions that, when you live in the city, it becomes intrinsically more difficult to own a car with kind of every urban megatrend that you see, right? In New York City alone, 9,000 restaurants converted parking into restaurant space, right? Everybody wants a greener, less polluted city, and pollution doesn't mean end pipe emissions. It means being full of metal boxes, and even if they're electrified, a city full of Teslas is still not as livable as a city full of green space and restaurants. And so, we think the pandemic, in a way, obviously started way before the pandemic. The pandemic, in a way, has manifested and accelerated the trend that we are trying to really capitalize on with what we're building, and give people a better solution to access cars when they live in a city, which is for a day, for a week, for a month, that's kind of the short story of where we came from. We said, if you want to really build a future-proof product in this space, and we're thinking 20, 25 years ahead, how will people access cars then when they live in a city. And you know, we said it needs to be accessible, like at your fingertips, right? On your phone, you need to have a few taps to get the car to come to you. Then the car needs to, like, it needs to be available. It needs to get like summoned to you because you don't want to store it outside your house. You don't want to store it in the garage. You want it to come to you almost like a, you know, like Tesla has the summon feature. We built that for entire cities. So the car kind of rolls up at your door on demand as, you know, whenever you need it. And then you need to be able to keep it for a day, for a week, for a month, for however long you want to be ultimately flexible. And then you get to pick up again and you don't have to worry about anything. That's our kind of product vision. And with the product that we build, we believe we're kind of knocking down every other kind of vertical in how people access cars today with, you know, an ultimate solution that is, you know, kind of a solution to a problem that I think we all agree is, you know, it's beyond painful if you don't have a car to go get one for a day, week, or month.
I want to know when the aha moment was. So you have three Germans. I'm imagining you guys sitting in a bar, drinking a beer, looking outside San Francisco, and just have this aha moment that, hey, we got to start this company. When was that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I wish I could give you that. I think it was a more, kind of drawn out process for the three of us. I mean, we just, you know, we stuck our heads together and we had different hypotheses about the space, right? We had a vision of how cities would look like in the future. We had, you know, a vision about how mobility would look like in the future, you know, how customers would access transportation in the future, having been part of that ecosystem for some time. And, you know, we thought, you know, what is a problem that is not a today problem, but what's a tomorrow problem we can start solving today and build a robust business around it that it actually, that allows it to, you know, to scale to a really, really large, large organization. And we said it, you know, there's a lot of innovation in the space, you know, as I mentioned earlier, but it's very crowded in kind of the micro space. How about the macro space? You know, we don't think there are many solutions to get people to live a carless life. But people, like 87% of trips in today are still made with personal vehicles. We believe in the freedom that comes with personal mobility. We just want to give people different access. And we think we have a different approach to it, right? You can build transportation solutions that kind of are substitutes to cars, which is great. And there are many ideas out there, right? Hyperloop, there, you know, trains and planes are all great for certain solutions. Micromobility is as well. But, you know, we are in the space where we say we take it head on. You know, if people want to drive, we let them drive. You know, but that doesn't mean just because you want to drive, you know, to get your vaccine, Dave, doesn't mean you need to store that Tesla outside your the Mustang outside your door all year round, right? It's not economical. It's not ecological. And it, you know, it doesn't make sense. So we like to look at it that way.
Interesting. One question I have is, Are there really enough people who would want to use a service like this? Because it seems to me that most of the car rentals happen at the airport. That's probably the biggest market share, right? About a third of car rentals happen at the airport. Even those that happen in a city like San Francisco is mostly visitors who need the car for a day. I see my case for the vaccine trip as a special case. I might not need to do that again anytime soon. So do you have a big enough market in these big cities?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So we don't look at the rental car market per se. For us, you know, the rental car market is a proxy in that, you know, when you think back to the Uber times, you know, for Uber, it was easy to get the frequent taxi customers, you know, that were unhappy with the payment solutions. They were unhappy with the intransparency, with the unreliability, lack of quality standards. They jumped on Uber, right? And it was the lowest hanging fruit, the easiest piece. But would Uber have started a company saying, we'll take over the taxi market? Absolutely not, right?
Right.
The taxi market is a fraction of the car service market that we tackle. But it is a massive company. Why is that? Because they were able to change behavior and they got ahead of consumer behavior changes, which was, you know, now people are, I mean, I'm using Uber frequently. I was not a frequent taxi user. I would have walked maybe, you know, similar to the scooter companies. You know, if you are creating market share by building a solution that wasn't there before, and we don't think, you know, taking away from Get Around and Turo and the traditional rentals is fine. And it works. And it did allow us to scale. I mean, we grew 30% month on month consistently for the last 3 months. So I think we are on a steep growth trajectory. But at the same time, you know, the interesting piece of the customer that we go after, that we want to, you know, convince of Kite, is the customer that doesn't own a car, lives in an urban city, and that share of the market is increasing. And these are not the people that would otherwise go to Budget or Hertz. You know, the, I would say 25 to 35 year old generation is not a frequent Hertz or Avis customer when it comes to the urban use case. We don't work on the airport. The airport is a, you know, in a certain way, when you look at the entirety of the industry, is a bloodbath, right? I mean, it's everybody is, I mean, not just during the pandemic, you know, air travel was depressed. It still remains depressed, you know, for the foreseeable future. No, like, differentiation, right? I mean, then you didn't care about whether it was Budget or Avis or Hertz or Enterprise or any of those. You just looked at the car, and if any one of them would have been $2 cheaper, you would have taken the other one. Mm-hmm. And that's a very, you know, that's what happens in a commoditized market. The way we look at it is, you know, we are on par, right? We're not a premium product, but Dan, we would have saved you the time, we would have saved you the hassle. I don't want to beat up too much on other market participants. We think we would have had the right product for you in that case. And then, you know, it also comes ultimately to, you know, the I would say the product of the pieces is larger than the sum, right? It's not just the delivery. I mean, like you mentioned in the beginning, it's a great catch. And, you know, when you get the car delivered and the surfer, as we call the drivers, tosses you the key, it's a magical moment, because the experience gap to what you would have experienced when you walked into a local shop, the car rental shop, or you would, you know, find an empty spot where you were promised, in, you know, one of the new rental company's cars. It's so wide that you do get, people get excited about it, but, you know, there's more, you know, the refueling, the, you know, the intransparency of the charges, the payment options, you know, seeing the car arrive, being able to flexibly extend, like all the, try to book a rental car on a mobile app. It's quite challenging today. You know, if you were in that position. So we want to make it, you know, Uber-esque in the way it is an experience. It is a gap in experience to the way things used to be. And to kind of, you know, circle back to the question, it's a growing market, in that, you know, more people will stay away from cars, you know, and we believe that we can have a small impact into that. When people think, do I need a car or not, they can now more frequently say they don't, because of the reliable service that we provide. That's not something that happens overnight, but ultimately, you know, transportation is the second largest spend in any household. And, you know, the largest chunk of that is for trips that are, you know, longer than 30 minutes. That's what we're really tapping into.
Great. So, yeah, that's a terrific answer to that question. And what I've read and understood from your articles in the past is you've started the business model by partnering with different rental car companies. So they're basically paying for the CapEx of the vehicle, and they're also paying for the parking area. Of course, you might be paying them some lease or some sort of nominal fee for that location. But that's a very straightforward business model, I assume, compared to what you're moving into the future. So when I think about you guys moving in the future, I'm thinking of collaborations with OEMs, right? For example, because what you said you're really working on is the technology and the customer. I assume the technology is getting the car and the customers is creating loyalty. So my understanding from that is, where do you see the Kite business changing over the next 10 years? And do you think AV will play a role in your proliferation?
Yeah, I might have to extend the timeline to more than 10 years, but I definitely, you know, we definitely spend a lot of time thinking about that. You know, we believe in fleets. Like, we don't believe in individual car ownership. So in any type of autonomous future, you know, be that, you know, teleoperated, like remote controlled cars in the near term, be that fully autonomous systems, we don't believe it makes sense that you two have your own autonomous cars at your door, right? So there is, or semi-autonomous, there is, so we believe in the future of fleets. We are building the infrastructure for these fleets. So today, we do have, you know, a set of, you know, seven or eight partners that we work with today who deploy their fleets via the Kite platform to consumers. And for us, it's a super important piece and a super important element of our business, because we want to ultimately allow any fleet owner to be able to, you know, deploy their assets the way these guys do. What role does autonomy play? We see it in two ways. One is on the kind of on the consumer side, and one is on the operation side. On the consumer side, with autonomous systems within cities, people will have fewer use cases for their own personal vehicles. You know, if people were commuting to work, they would own a car. If they now use an autonomous taxi system, or rideshare system, they would even have even more use cases for that, and their cars would sit idle even more. So we see, you know, people moving away from car ownership more and more and more. We will see a move towards more like purpose-built vehicles, right? There will be vehicles that will have six seats that will be, you know, slanted in a way that, you know, it is made for, you know, shared taxis. There will be those that are made for the long distance, right? I mean, you have two electric cars. One is a Nissan Leaf and one is a Tesla, and they're both great cars to a certain degree. But, you know, the Nissan Leaf is supposed to take you to go grocery shopping, and the Tesla Model S, it takes you from San Francisco to LA, right? And I think these are, you know, some of the things that we look at, and when we you know, build up kind of our hypotheses about the future, that people will want these purpose-built vehicles for different transportation use cases, and hence, you know, a sharing in whatever form that may be, will be the answer to solving different transportation needs while keeping costs economical, right? Mm-hmm. So on the consumer side, we're excited about it. Our use case to get a car for a day, for a week, for a month, let's just think of, you know, a trip to Yosemite. In what we're building, you know, we're ultimately agnostic to the hardware, right? We are agnostic to whether it's an electric, it's a plug-in hybrid, or it's an ICE engine. We are also agnostic to whether we have driver assist systems, or, you know, today you can, half of our cars, you have a pretty robust driver assist. And then, you know, or if they're fully autonomous, you will still, you know, want to be in that personal vehicle. You will still want to access through your phone, and you want to have it, you know, come to you, you know, on demand. And then you want to keep it flexibly. And so all of that infrastructure we build, whether the cars are autonomous or not, doesn't impact our kind of the core use case of what we're building in any profound way. So we are building, you know, for that future. On the operations side, it's obviously a very, very interesting, you know, element of the business that we are going to be able to deliver cars remote controlled in even a teleoperated scenario. And we are so excited about teleoperations because the barriers from a regulatory and technology perspective are much, much lower than to full autonomy. You know, you can, you know, certain things just very like, and again, here on the most non-technical person in the entire company, you know, speaking about this to you. The you know, in teleoperations, in our, we are kind of a the prime commercial use case for teleoperations, and that there's no driver in the car. So you, from a regulatory perspective, you don't have, you know, passenger traveling in the car. It's empty. It's the same kind of risk profile than if Nuro delivers you a pizza, which they do today, and I believe I'm not sure where it is exactly. You want to get it? Yeah. So, you know, it's the same thing, just the car delivers itself. And, you know, so from that perspective, it's pretty straightforward. And then on the other hand, when we get to the kind of technological aspects of it, we can deliver at low speeds because when we deliver, you know, we don't have a passenger in the car that's, you know, that's annoyed. We might have, you know, we might have an issue with the rest of the travel, rest of the road traffic. So does Nuro. But, you know, it's a much easier use case than kind of the, I guess, the piece of the pie that's Waymo now, you know, obviously more aggressively stepping into, you know, Aurora and other players in the space. Cruise here in San Francisco prominently, or Zoox, right? What we're doing is we believe, you know, no matter where you kind of have your own vision of the autonomous scenario or fully autonomous scenarios, be that in, you know, 10, 15, 20, 25 years, there will be a time where teleoperations will be ahead of all this for a long time. And we'll have a, you know, very interesting commercial use case, which then also, getting back to the question before, will expand the market share, because now suddenly we can economically deliver to the suburbs. We can economically deliver in, you know, Albuquerque, you know, smaller cities, because we're not constrained by the density of the cities, as we are today to a certain degree. We're a business that, you know, strives to be profitable to a certain degree, right? Albeit being venture funded, so we don't deliver to the suburbs today, but that is, you know, market a part of the market that we're really excited about as we, you know, deploy tele operations technology.
So how do you build loyalty amongst people like Dan? Because Dan lives in San Francisco. He's your perfect customer right now, perfect demographic. He doesn't own a car, and he only gets a car when he really needs to go somewhere. So how do you prevent him from using Turo or Enterprise or any other company?
Yeah, Dan is perfect for us. You're right. So the biggest driver of retention for us is ultimately just good execution, right? If the quality is there, if the consistency of the quality is there, people don't go back to use any other services. I mean, we only have, you know, kind of internal NPS surveys, you know, where we ask people how upset they would be, if the product wouldn't exist anymore, where we ask people kind of, you know, have you used any other service? Have you used any other service since? And I mean, yeah, the responses that we're getting, they're amazing, right? And people are excited, right? We have an 85 NPS today. Over 60% of our revenue is from recurring customers. And in that internal survey, just as an example, 77% said they've never used any other service. So that's phenomenal for us. And you know, frankly, we don't always get it right, right? We're still learning. We're a small but growing company. If we get it right, we're very confident that people don't return to any other service. And Dan, I mean, you're just gonna have to try it. And if you churn, you know, we're obviously very curious and eager to learn always. If people use other services, then we want to learn from it. But had opportunities to learn, but we think again, ultimately, no loyalty program, no discount, and no kind of retention mechanism that we can build into the product will be as powerful as just the best product.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point, because you mentioned, if I use budget, but if Avis were $2 cheaper, I would pick Avis. That's true to an extent, but I think there is some customer preference for different services. Maybe people like Enterprise. I think that's true for the travel industry in general, with airlines and hotels as well. So yeah, I think finding that customer loyalty is key. You said something interesting. Yeah. You brought up Neuro, and I thought it was interesting you brought them up, because in a way, it's a very parallel business. They're delivering pizzas and deliveries in urban environments. You're delivering cars, often in urban environments, although you also mentioned you're looking to expand more to rural areas. That's really great. So right now, you're available in, is it 6 different cities in the U.S.?
7 as of last Friday. We launched in Miami, yeah.
You just launched in Miami. Congratulations. So how do you choose which cities are best for you to deploy in? And what are the major factors that put you in those cities that you've chosen instead of Albuquerque, New Mexico, like you mentioned?
Yeah, it's on the list, just not yet. So again, there is a certain scale of a city that is, too small for us to operate, right now. Again, we're a team of, just under 40 people. So we start with kind of the, let's say it's the Uber launch roadmap, right? You go to the big cities first, because they're, the predominant kind of leading factor is people without a car. And people without a car is a function of how many people do live in the city? So what's the size of the city? And what's the ratio of households without a car? New York City is probably, has the highest kind of factor here. San Francisco was good. And, we kind of, work our way down from those cities. So that's kind of the starting point. We have to kind of focus our energy on kind of the, I guess, the lowest hanging fruit in that. And a market like New York City, San Francisco, Boston, DC, Miami, like all of those areas, we're able to grow for an extended period of time as we are building kind of the robust operating model that will make us profitable in a smaller city like Albuquerque. Don't want to beat on small town in New Mexico now all day, but obviously our goal is in the next 5 years we'll be in well over 100 cities. So we will not be able, even as we go internationally, we're not going to be able to be only in Paris, Berlin, Munich, and Vancouver. We are going to move to smaller cities as well to serve the population there. In a way, like what's something that, and really getting kind of under the hood of the operations here, one of the things that's really, really just helpful for us in launching, even smaller cities, and we are in DC now, not all that large when it comes down to it, is that, you know, we are able to launch without the need for minimum scale. You know, imagine you open your Zipcar app and you see 12 cars on the map. You will likely be frustrated because it's not going to be a block away like they promised. When you open our app, the car will be outside of your door, whether we have 550 or 500 cars in that city. So we are able to produce that perfect customer experience that we promised from the start, build a loyal customer base, you know, and kind of keep a very healthy economic footprint, you know, in a city, produce, you know, actually a healthy business, despite, you know, not like a, like the OEM attempts, you know, when OEMs were, you know, exploring kind of the mobility space, they would throw 500 cars at a city because they had the metal, right? So they would do that, and that helped them get to that density. We have we're very fortunate that we're able to have a more nimble approach in that sense.
Great. Thank you. So when a startup like Uber launched, all they had was they picked you up and they take you to point B, from A to B. Now what they finally had was Uber Pool, Uber Eats. So they've expanded on different revenue streams. Do you see Kite doing that in the future in different areas?
So great question. I mean, I would need to refer to my co-founder and you know, getting the actual like number of years in play that they were before they came, you know, up with the Pool even, and now Uber Eats, right? I think generally in building a startup, it's all about focus, right? If the reason we are faster than anybody else is because we're focused on that core use case, getting cars to people. Do we get creative, you know, and when we have happy hours and, you know, talk about all the things that we could do and in strategy sessions? I mean, absolutely, right? And the space is super large. But we are, you know, very fortunate in that, you know, our core use case is kind of far from exhausted, right? It's a massive market. You know, we're launching at rapid speed. We're now, you know, we barely kind of surpassed kind of the eight-figure revenue mark, right? So there is, I mean, it's still day one, right? So for us, like, really hard to think about, you know, what we'll do next. In terms of different products, we are seeing, you know, longer use cases that we're serving, but, you know, and we're seeing shorter use cases that we're serving. We're seeing people with second cars. We're seeing, you know, insurance replacements, but all of that still has kind of the same core infrastructure, right? The same core is we give you the best way to access a car. And that we don't think will change anytime soon, just given just how large that market is, and we have no struggle growing this right now, fortunately. Yeah. But it's always exciting. You know, we think the right now it's more showing penetration, right, at the same time, rather than going to letting our creativity too loose and going into different verticals. Yeah. We still have three car classes, right? I mean, Dan, you wouldn't get a Mustang from us today. Well, A, because Ford is struggling to produce them, and B, because it is, you know, we still have only three car classes, right? We believe in simplicity and focus, right? If we get the experience right every time, then you're going to be less concerned about, you know, is it a sedan or is it an economy or is it a, you know, full size car? For us, there are small cars that are economical. There are medium-sized cars that are, you know, regular sedans, and then there are SUVs for people that need more space. You know, obviously, you know, we'll do ski racks and we'll do, you know, child seats. I have a one-year-old. I mean, I need a child seat. So we'll do all those things, right? But for now, really, you know, focus over everything, which I think gives us the speed to really, really aggressively grow the service and bring it to more people out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you planning to add luxury cars to your lineup? Because sometimes if I want to take a quick trip up to Mill Valley or Sausalito, I think it'd be kind of nice to just have a Maserati for a day. Or...
I mean, I would say it's, you know, similar answer. I don't know how many there are, you know, that are like this. You know, I think in the longer run, right, for us, of course, like different car portfolios, you know, if we can increase the utility of a vehicle and, you know, have cars that are not sitting idle because we have the demand for them, then absolutely, yes, you know, minivans are something that, you know, we know, mm-hmm. like group travel, you know, is coming back, and we know that people appreciate that. So we are, you know, we're listening to our consumers, and if we have enough people that call about Maseratis, we will have them. I think they will come second to minivans, maybe convertibles, you know, some other classes before we'll go into the luxury. But I agree. It would be nice one day to be able to satisfy all use cases. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one. I have one more question regarding that. Right now, you're renting from. I mean, you're getting these cars from rental companies. Is there a plan in the future, like to get it directly from an individual and add them to your portfolio?
There are plans to change the setup. Yes. But they're more the other way around, right? So when we think, you know, even 10 years ahead, we know that the rental car companies don't have the robust infrastructure to really provide 10, 50, 100,000 cars on the platform. It's the reason why they don't do this themselves, right? It, you know, to a very question that we get frequently, why don't they do this themselves? Because it's difficult, and it's a hard engineering problem to solve, you know, to dispatch autonomously drivers, vehicles, customers, and, you know, make everybody happy in the process. So, you know, we are going to move beyond that, but I don't think we will integrate into kind of individuals, people's cars, because we don't think individuals should own cars. So you know, while that would be a short-sighted move from us to satisfy, you know, a certain part of the marketplace. But what we're really after is building a robust model where dealers, OEMs, you know, larger fleet managers, you know, distributors are moving into the model, kind of more upward integrating than downward integrating into the individuals. We're seeing interest from larger and larger fleets. We're seeing interest from the OEMs, from distributors to be able to deploy, you know, more cars to more people. And that's what we're very actively pursuing. Yes.
Great. And then finally, do you have any advice for new graduates or other professionals that want to enter your industry?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd say just do it, right? You know, us three, when we started the company, you know, we had kind of good running jobs, right? And we enjoyed our time. We were all fairly good in what we were doing. And it was, you know, somewhat scary to go to, you know, no salary, and you can go start, you know, deliver cars to people and try to understand consumers deeply and what they wanted. And now, you know, after we've gained some traction and we're able to attract investment and actually, you know, make a lot of customers happy, it seems like a no-brainer. In the moment, it didn't. And I think, you know, if people have the entrepreneurial bug or and you know want to make a dent in the space, there's no better time than now. I think that's like a very generalized thing, a general thing. It's always the best time now, but it's also a really good time because this space is changing so rapidly now more than ever.
What's the number one skill someone needs to do what you do?
Not sure if this is a skill, but it's really good to be humble and to understand, you know, that there are a lot of things that we are not good at and that I'm not good at, and to understand that there is still a lot that we need to learn. And yes, it's good to celebrate what we've achieved, but we're still, you know, humbled by, you know, the journey that's ahead of us. You know, if we continue to grow at the rate at which we're growing, this company outgrows us. And I think acknowledging that is a good thing. And yeah, I think that's a very key part of it, of a journey like this. It can get very stressful, and keeping a clear head, forming, you know, strong hypotheses about the future, right? Because obviously things come in the way. You know, we started this company, and you know, in March 2020, you know, two of our largest markets effectively had people not leave the house, right? So you're building a transportation company when people didn't use transportation. You know, we built a company on, you know, some degree of business travel, and business travel hasn't recovered until today. You know, Uber and Lyft entered the space, right? It's interesting for us, and we feel a certain degree of validation by that. But it's also, you know, very turbulent. You know, it's a roller coaster. Every I think every entrepreneur would describe that. So it's good to have a North Star and know kind of why we're doing this, right? So if there is a bad quarter, like we certainly had, you know, when in Q1 we had full lockdowns in two of our largest and most mature markets, when we weren't profitable in those markets yet, that's a good time to kind of, you know, we as a full team, you know, thought back to like, why are we doing this? We want to give people access to better transportation. So we were standing there kind of, you know, on the spot, we're not growing. So we said, let's keep doing what we're doing. Let's give cars to frontline workers and let's get them to work, because those guys still need cars. They didn't have any. And, you know, car rental shops around the city were closed. You know, so we said, let us do this, right? We partnered with UCSF at the time, you know, partnered with, you know, a few other institutions and just tried to keep chipping away at that vision that we have. I think maybe that's a second thing, you know, not having a North Star, not a skill, but maybe something to think about.
To put kite aside for a second, we always like that, Dan and I like to ask our user or our guests, what is it? What is something you're really good at, a hobby, a sport, an interest that we could let other users know, for example, or other listeners know, for example, if you really like golf, what are the best golf clubs to go golfing at? Or if you really like beer, what's the best beer? What's the best wine?
Oh, wow. what am I good at?
Or enjoy?
I mean, I enjoy cooking a lot. I don't know if I'm particularly good at it, but I enjoy that. And I don't know. I think it's somewhat of a life skill, right? It can be very meditative. It can be very useful. It can be a lot of fun. Can be very social. So before I go to a restaurant or order food, I'd always invite people to the house and try to cook something. So that's maybe something. I don't know what people can learn from it.
Maybe there's a favorite. If you're really good at cooking, you must enjoy food. So is there a favorite restaurant in San Francisco that you enjoy?
One of my favorite restaurants, and I'm fortunate to sit across from it, our office is Wild Seed. It's probably one of the best vegan restaurants in San Francisco. Uh-huh. They have a barbecue platter that is very vegan and will blow your mind. Maybe because it isn't, because it tastes really well. I can recommend that.
Well, I gotta go there because
I have to try that out.
That's great. Awesome. Thank you very much. That was a terrific podcast, and I think our listeners will really enjoy it. So tune in next time, where we're going to host the CEO of Sense Photonics, Shauna McIntyre.